to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. I thank you so much for joining us here on the program. We do come your way every Sunday at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m., Monday mornings at 1 a.m., streaming live at those times. The podcasts are both on the homepage and radio shows page of richarddugan.com, and they are posted on SoundCloud, iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, TuneIn Radio, Blueberry, Player FM, and a whole bunch of others that folks are linking us to, and we are grateful for that, and we certainly hope that you will listen to the entire interview. Sometimes we go more than 50 minutes. That's what we get for the radio broadcast. You need to hear more of what our guest is going to be talking about today. I guarantee you that for sure. I will probably have to go back and listen to it because he'll probably give me some insights on myself that I didn't know and I need to learn, which gives you a clue as to what we're going to be talking about today. We have in studio with us, and I am very grateful that he's in studio with us, Dr. Barton Goldsmith. He is a psychotherapist. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm, correct.
You are here in Santa Barbara locally.
Yes, on and off.
On and off. I guess you're living down in L.A.?
We have a house in L.A. We have a house in Westlake, and we're up here sometimes.
House in Newport?
No.
Kennebunkport?
No.
This port and that
stay
port?
In,
every
stay,
other
stay
port.
In SoCal.
There you go. And it's great to have you in studio. I have had folks on who are the ones that like to play, I jokingly say this, who like to play mind games with us.
Yes, yeah.
Who I sometimes wonder, by the time the interview is over, they've completely figured me out, you know, and then I've got to coax out of them. Okay, so what do you have to say about me?
You would need a board of psychotherapists to really figure that out, five or six people that were.
Which I wouldn't mind. I'd get a very diverse analysis. And in a manner of speaking, that's kind of what you do. I know that there are all kinds of, I'm going to call them philosophies.
Yes.
I took psychology in college. I did very poorly in it, but I enjoyed it because of the focus on the different aspects of human personality.
Mm-hmm.
The id, the ego, the superego, that kind of thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Jungian and Freudian and any other Ian that you can think of. And I found it so fascinating. And with this program, one of the things that we focus on and we've been focusing on for some time is knowing thyself. That phrase, know thyself.
Yes.
Okay. Because if you don't know who you are and what you are, what makes you tick, it's difficult to figure out what your place is in the community in which you live, let alone in the society, civilization.
Very good point.
Yeah.
But it's not just what makes you tick. It's also what makes you talk. It's
okay.
A play on words. Okay?
Sure.
It's not just what makes you tick is what you want,
mm-hmm.
right? That's your goals. But there's also a part of you that's not necessarily goal-oriented that just wants to be. You know, you want to be a human being, not a human doing, as John Bradshaw said, right? So you need to look at both aspects.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, you have a lot of, I guess I could say, accolades to your name. You've accomplished an awful lot in the years that you've been doing which has been how
Thank
long?
You.
How many years?
I guess about 30.
30. You've got books coming out your ears, almost. You and I apparently go to the same barber.
Yes.
You
yes.
know? I go to Drake over here at Victorian Court, the Victorian Salon, and enjoy that. But you have several books here. And actually, two of them that I was looking at that you had given me prior, I actually thought, you know, you could actually make these two books into one. The first book is Emotional Fitness for Intimacy. The second one is Emotional Fitness at Work. And the third one would be Emotional Fitness for Intimacy at Work. However, we've seen how that's gone, haven't we?
There's a lot of problems, yes.
A lot of problems.
That causes a lot of difficulty.
You know
life.
What? I'm going to ask you to start there. Let's start with these issues of inappropriate behavior in the wrong venues and sometimes with the wrong person. In today's Me Too movement age,
mm-hmm.
where women have been walking around scared for centuries.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Men are now walking around scared.
Yes.
And I was sharing that observation with a woman, and we were talking about these issues, and she came back with considerable attitude, join the club.
Mm.
But it's like she has every right to say it that way. because women have been walking around scared for centuries.
Forever.
Talk to us about how we can get over or overcome the first of all, the imbalance that's been going on as long as man's been on the planet, man and woman. And now the backlash that seems like the pendulum is going way over to the other side, and how we can bring it back to some kind of a happy medium where I can walk down the street without fear of looking at a woman in just the wrong way, with maybe a smirk on my face because I'm thinking of something else, and all of the sudden I am being accused of whatever she feels
being
like.
Being inappropriate.
Yeah, being inappropriate. Okay. So how is there, and I don't know, we're not trying to solve these problems necessarily, but we're trying to address them and maybe come up with some way, some steps that we can take as individuals to come back to a happy medium where we're not afraid of each other.
I think that there's a one-word answer, and that is civility.
Ooh.
We're no longer civilized. We don't treat people with that kind of respect. Mm-hmm. And if we just did that, then I think things would balance out. It's not that people don't have women don't have a right to be upset with how they've been subjugated for the last million years, right? I mean, it's horrible what people have done to one another, what men have done to women. I don't like it, but I think the way out of it for men and for women is to be civil to one another and think on that level. Or I don't want to say kindness, but that's a big piece of it. Mm-hmm. That's a big piece of it. But just being respectful and understanding that some people have different kind of boundary issues, right? And also, if you are acting inappropriate, you know you're acting inappropriately. Mm-hmm. I mean, unless you are mentally deficient, and some people who are do not realize they are acting inappropriately, and we are hoping that they get the right kind of help. But most of us who are walking around on the street, and if you see someone, you don't just, you know, say, hey, you, you act appropriately, you are polite.
Yeah.
And I think we came from an age where, you know, there was it was just way, we went the other way too far.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And with all the stuff that's coming out with Jeffrey Epstein and you know.
Oh, and congressmen. And now there's one woman, last name Hill, I believe it is, who she's stepping down because of an inappropriate relationship, supposedly breaking congressional rules. And now she's stepping down because she acknowledges, yes, years before I became, I think, the congresswoman, yes, I had an inappropriate relationship with a staffer, or maybe it was early on in her career. And it's like, I'm sitting here going, really? And then there's the double standard. There are some people who have been accused, they've stepped down, others who have been accused, and they do nothing. They deny it, they deny it, they deny it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, wait a minute. These people still are denying it, but they step down because they don't want to deal with the backlash. But you're staying in your position, whatever that is, and yet you've got dozens of women who are accusing you of inappropriate behavior.
It's
weird.
It's unfortunately that those men still have that power, that negative power, the one where they can do that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's changing. You have to see that it's changing. The hashtag movement did start it, and it's going to take a while to get to the people that aren't stepping down. But then there are people who just immediately walked away, like Senator Al Franken.
Al Franken was the one I was thinking of,
You know, and I think he was a great man. I think he is a great man.
Yeah.
And I hope he comes back in some way because he really was a good American.
Yeah.
But he got himself into trouble because of something that happened way in his past, right, when he was a comedian. And it's a shame. I see both sides of it. And, you know, I support him. I support the woman. I wish there was another way that he could have worked it out. So,
and what's really strange with that kind of a dichotomy is if you believe the woman, then you're not believing the man. He's saying, I didn't do anything. And I'm not saying Franken said this. I'm just talking about other issues. They say, I didn't do it. You know, and then if you believe the man, now you're not believing the woman said, it was done to me. You know, it's like, We have this real problem with who we're going to believe. You know, it's almost like you have to take sides.
But it's more of a psychological process than a legal one in certain senses. We have to hear both people, right? I mean, the woman has the right to be heard. The man needs to be heard as well.
Yeah.
The percentage of false accusations is very, very low, but they do happen.
They do happen.
And we have to listen. We have to take what people say, bring it in, evaluate it. How does that feel to us? How does that feel to the other people in the room, if there are? How does that feel to the person being accused or the person doing the accusing?
Yeah, yeah.
What's really going on here on a deeper level so that healing can take place?
Yes.
Not just accusations, but healing.
And I'll even throw two other things. One is I'll even throw in a third word. Civility, kindness, and forgiveness. Not necessarily or specifically of the other person, mm-hmm. but of self. I was watching a documentary where these kids were kidnapped and held underground in this semi-truck trailer for 18 or 22 hours or whatever it was, and they found a way out. They were able to get out themselves, which
right.
was really miraculous. Well, now they're interviewing these people as adults, and mm-hmm. they're talking about this. And this gentleman, you're okay. And this gentleman, an adult now, actually went to one of the kidnappers who did his time and is out of jail. He forgave the man who had kidnapped him and the other 10 or 12, whatever, how many school kids there were.
Mm-hmm.
And he spoke of this incredible weight that just suddenly lifted, that he was finally free. Now, that doesn't mean he forgets, but it's like that to me is a huge element in this of forgiveness. We're not talking about forgetting. We're not talking about excusing the behavior or excusing the accusation. Because that has nothing to do truly with forgiveness, does it?
No, but on the level you're speaking of, forgiveness is a gift that you are giving to yourself. It's not forgiving what happened to you.
Yeah.
It's forgiving so that you can move forward.
Exactly. I know that a lot of people have trouble with that. I want to come back and talk with you more about that as we continue on this program. We're talking with Dr. Barton Goldsmith. He has... Like, I only have a few of the books here. How many books do you have out right now?
I think seven, eight.
Seven? And we have a few of them here. 100 Ways to Boost Your Self-Confidence. We're going to talk about that as well. You also have The Happy Couple, How to Make Happiness a Habit, One Little Loving Thing at a Time, which is now in Chinese, if you'd like to read it in Chinese, as well as the two books that I mentioned. The third one is not out, is not going to be coming out anytime soon. Emotional Fitness at Work and Emotional Fitness for Intimacy. Here we are talking with the doctor and getting a little insight into ourselves. As we continue talking here, I really want to try to find a space where we can discuss the aspect of, and I'm going to go ahead and jump into this one, this particular book here in reference to emotional fitness for intimacy. First of all, and I remember going through both marriage encounter, engaged encounter with my first wife,
mm-hmm.
And the subject, of course, came up. And I've been through different programs, self-improvement programs over the years. I went through Life Spring, and mm-hmm. I went through Delta and Omega Vector in Phoenix. That was where it was headquartered. Read a lot of books. I've interviewed a lot of people, and the word intimacy – specifically, guys have the biggest problem with what that really is.
That's why I wrote that book.
What is it?
The reason that book has 52 chapters in it.
One for every week of the year.
One for every week of the year. One chapter is on sex. That's the mathematical equation of how important sex is to intimacy.
Okay.
1 to 52. Okay, if you do all of the other stuff, your intimate life is going to be lovely.
Yeah.
Right? No matter how sexual or unsexual it is,
mm-hmm.
that sexual part will be lovely if the intimacy is there to carry you through. It's a feeling, not an act. It's a process, not an event.
Yeah. One can be intimate with one's partner even in the most public, crowded places that you can find.
Absolutely.
Because, again, we're going to go back to what you just said. 52 to 1, sex is one of the 52. The other 51 have to do with a whole lot more. Compassion, consideration. What about chivalry?
Chivalry is not dead.
Thank you.
It is still here. I get the door held open for me by women now, which is surprising. Yeah. I usually like walk a couple steps ahead and open the door. I'm always opening my wife's door and pulling out her chair and doing that. That is the way I was brought up,
right.
But not so much because of that. Because I know that if I do those tiny little loving things, I'm going to get back a whole lot more. And
yeah.
It's so easy.
Yeah.
And the other part is I want her to feel like she's a queen.
Right.
Because that aspect of her, then she bestows things on me. She grants me castles and kingdoms and things.
Sure,
you know, But if you make your partner feel really, really loved, you're going to get a lot of love back.
Yeah.
I mean, it's you don't give to get.
No,
because
no.
The giving aspect of it, for me, is fun. I
yeah.
like it.
Yeah.
I mean, and intimacy goes a very long way. She gets a romantic text every day. Sometimes it's a picture. Sometimes it's something that I've written.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes she gets something from the internet because my jokes aren't that funny.
Thank goodness the internet is there.
Where would we be? But the idea is that every day you do something to make your intimacy a little tiny bit deeper.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And if you get into that, it becomes a habit. Right, then your life becomes better.
Yeah. Sometimes it's just a phrase. My wife and I had a conversation just a few days ago in reference to our collection of animals.
Mm-hmm.
We have one big 110-pound King Shepherd named Angus.
Mm-hmm.
We have 5 cats. We have 4 chickens. And we were sitting in our travel trailer. We were kind of playing with it and just seeing how the different things work and hookups and this and that and the other. And we were sitting there and she says, you know, we could live in this. Well, I became real practical. Now, it'll only sleep 2. It's only 20 feet long and only sleeps 2.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, I don't think that would be real practical because I don't know what the cats wouldn't. They wouldn't put up with it. And, of course, she looks at me and says, well, I thought we were going to be on the same page. And I got to thinking about it. I thought, okay, if we absolutely had to, all right, we probably couldn't. And I didn't say that to her at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But I could see she was upset. So a couple days later, as we're driving to work, I said, I just want you to know, in lieu of our conversation the other day, I will do everything in my power to make sure our family, animals and humans, stay together. And if that means that we have to figure out how to live in that 20-foot trailer, okay.
Hey,
I just
nice
want to
re
I just want to reassure you that we're not getting rid of anybody. Everybody stays.
Good for you.
And she appreciated that.
Mm-hmm.
But that was one of those phrases, if you will. And I had thought about it over the 24 to 36 hours after the first conversation. You know, and I thought, you know, what's the big deal? I mean, we've moved from a 1,300 square foot house in Phoenix. It was 2 bedrooms, believe it or not, 2 baths, 2 bedrooms and 2 baths. Really? A very nice house and yard and the whole thing. Plenty of room if we had 5 cats at the time. And we moved here to a 2 bedroom cottage up on the hill that probably isn't more than 1,000 square feet. Maybe 1,000 square feet. And we have what we have. When you're thinking about these acts of intimacy, these expressions, maybe that's a better way to put it, these mm-hmm. expressions of intimacy.
Yes.
You did use a few key words in there. What would be the first word specifically for guys, since it's us guys talking here,
mm-hmm.
here in our man cave? I might have a studio in my man cave one day, too. What's that first word that the guys need to be thinking about when it's like you chose this woman, she chose you, you chose to be together, so do something with the choosing here.
I think
what's the first word?
What's 2 words, really?
Two words, okay.
I think you need to start out every conversation with, I'm sorry.
Okay. Yeah, but you better know what you're sorry for, because she's going to call you.
I'm kidding.
Yeah,
I'm kidding. But you, the way I start out a conversation between couples, the way I teach people how to communicate, first, you get their attention.
Okay.
You know, now, sometimes that requires a 2x4 upside the head, but their attention.
Mm-hmm.
I think that couples need to, at least once a day, and seriously, this takes 1 minute. 1 minute. Sit together, face each other, hold hands, inhale together, exhale together, look each other in the eyes, and simply acknowledge verbally or even non-verbally, I love you, I'm here for you, let's go out and do what we need to do today, and we get to come back tonight and be together.
Mm.
And whether you express that, again, verbally or non-verbally, it doesn't matter, but
right.
That connection, the connection is really important. I also advise couples, before they leave the house for the day, a 10-second hug and kiss,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, and when you come back, goodbyes and, you know,
and hellos
are really important.
Yeah.
Are really important.
We have adopted a phrase, a Gaelic phrase. We will certainly say, I love you, to each other in
mm-hmm.
English. And then we will then, as we are almost turning our backs on each other and going our separate ways when I drop her off at the clinic, slán gafal, which is goodbye until later.
Very nice.
And it's even on the phone. It's the end of the conversation is slán gafal. Yeah. And so if you can come up with something like that, for example, when I end these programs, at the end of every program, and I thought about this at the beginning of the very first show we ever did, September 7th of 2007, I'm going, I really want something to go out with that I can use every week to close the show, but that has some meaning.
Mm-hmm.
And I always end the show with, and love to Lal, which is Sanskrit for my beloved.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously that is to my wife, Amrita. So if you incorporate those kinds of, I almost want to say rituals.
Behaviors.
And behaviors.
Habits.
Habits. It goes a long way, doesn't it?
Very long way, because it makes you both feel reassured. The biggest relationship killer is insecurity.
Oh, yeah.
So if you start feeling insecure around your partner, then you start behaving differently. Your partner thinks you're weird. It goes back and forth. They start behaving differently. And pretty soon you're into some kind of a mix-up, a miscommunication that it really had no business being, right? Communication is the most important thing in a relationship. There's no question about that. But we miscommunicate much of the time, and we don't stop it. You can do, look, we're in a miscommunication here. Let's stop. Let's de-escalate and see where we went wrong. We don't need to argue.
Yeah.
We don't need to argue. I mean, they're going to happen. No two people can live together in a 1,000-square-foot house
mm-hmm.
and not step on each other's toes, even in a 5,000-square-foot house.
Exactly.
It's going to happen, right? But if you resolve those things quickly and easily, right, you just say, oops, that hurt. You stepped on my toes. Sorry, won't do that again. Thanks for letting me know. How can I make up for it?
Yeah.
Right? The important aspects of when you step on someone's toes, how to apologize, right? And then you go on. You don't hold grudges. This is the biggest reason relationships break up.
Mm.
You've got just a big stack of resentments. You can't get over them, so you divorce. You break up instead of resolving them, which is not that difficult.
Yeah.
If you're willing to let go of your own resentments. You said one thing earlier that I would call it an I love you code,
mm-hmm.
right? And I did write a column on that for the Santa Barbara News Press. And I think that what we do is we develop our little codes between couples.
Mm-hmm.
Back in the days of beepers, there was I had an assistant, and she would text her code beep her husband 111, and he would beep her 112, which is I love you and I love you too. I mean, that went back that far and further. Post-its, right? And getting post-its in your pocket, and now of course texts. The more you can say I love you in different ways,
mm-hmm.
right? The more your partner is going to hear them.
Yeah.
And some people have a hard time with ILY. Okay.
Yeah.
You know, I'll come up with something different. Yeah. And I mean, I get a different nickname every 6 or 8 months.
Mm-hmm.
and
has Mud been one of them?
Not yet, but don't give her ideas.
Okay.
Don't give her ideas. But you know, again, I think it's really important to have those little special things yeah. that are just between the two of you. Yeah.
I remind myself when something like that happens, I try to remind myself of why I'm even in this relationship. I mean, it's not a huge, difficult answer to come up with. You know, I'm in this relationship because I love this woman. We're good together. We create great things together. As I was sharing earlier about how we finally got the truck we've always wanted, and we now have the travel trailer that we've always wanted, mm-hmm. so that we look at what we've created together. We could not have done it independent of one another. I couldn't have gone off and done this without her. So I just remind myself of all of the wonderful experiences. We've been to Ireland twice. We are desperate
Nice.
To get back.
Mm-hmm.
Desperate to get back. It's been at least 10 years, 9 or 10 years, if not longer. No, it's, I beg your pardon, it's longer than that.
It's one of my favorite countries.
2004 was the last time we were there, so yeah. You folks do the math. In any event, so that's what I remind myself of and saying, okay, look, that's for me, that helps me to de-escalate. That's why are we doing this? And it used to be that it was sort of a knockdown, drag-out verbal thing. And I used to say things that I wish now I had never said. But we've come to a place now where all of that's behind us. That's okay. Everything's good. And it's not to say that we don't have disagreements like what I shared mm-hmm. earlier. But the fact of the matter is that human beings, whether you're in an intimate relationship or not, we have them. At work, my boss and I will have disagreements about things. One thing I do not have a disagreement with you about is, of course, the pile of books I have here and with the information that you have available to us. Barton Goldsmith, PhD, is my guest here on the program, and we are talking about the work that he does here. I want to ask you, Dr. Barton Goldsmith, why did you go down this path? Why did you go out and get your PhD? Why does psychotherapy, I don't know if psychology falls into that, and all of those other realms, right?
It's a different license. Is what it is.
Why did you go down this path? What was the impetus?
I was in a very close relationship with the first love of my life. I guess you can have two. I've proved that.
Mm-hmm.
She passed away, and I was only 30 years old. And it was just too hard on me. And I decided to seek out a therapist that I had known and worked with earlier. And after working with him for a while, I decided to pursue the path myself.
Mm-hmm.
Before that, I was a rock and roll guitar player.
Oh, wow.
And did a bunch of different things in Hollywood, but got educated, you know, went back to school, and then worked in the media with David Viscott on his show for a decade, and pursued that part of it, as well as seeing individual clients and getting up close and personal with the struggle that we all go through. There, I don't know anyone who doesn't struggle. I don't know anyone who doesn't deal with a little bit of depression, despite what some people say, that they have yeah. never been depressed. I had Peter Kramer, an eminent psychiatrist, on my radio show when I was on KCLU a number of years ago, and he said, no, I've never been depressed. I don't know about you, mm-hmm. but if I was dealing with depression, I don't think I'd want to see someone who's never been depressed.
Yeah.
Because how are they going to know?
Yeah, exactly,
right?
Exactly.
So, you know, I don't deal with clients who I haven't walked in their shoes on some level. And being a neurotic Jew, I think I've probably dealt with most neuroses and feel comfortable working myself out of them. I mean, we've all had dark times. I had a very dark one. My therapy dog died, and it was very, very hard for me to deal with that after being with her, her being with me for 10 years and working together. And it was hard on my clients as well. I mean, I was crying for a year offline. But, you know, you do get through it.
Yeah.
Right? You can let it take you over, but the object is to have enough love in your life that you don't fall down that pit.
Yeah. My regular attire and color scheme in my, I'm going to say my early 20s, and I'm not going to say that I was necessarily depressed, was browns.
Mm-hmm. Just variations. You know,
yeah, and variations thereon. And now, even though today I am actually wearing a brown shirt, but I've got a black T-shirt and blue jeans, it's not all of my wardrobe. Brown is not all of them. I like the brighter colors and so on and so forth. But a lot of times you can tell just by sometimes looking at someone, not necessarily the clothes they're wearing and the colors they've chosen, but the look on their face. You get a feeling, don't you?
Of course.
And that's one of the aspects that I'd like to talk about as we continue. And we are talking with Barton Goldsmith, PhD. We're talking about, again, you have 7 books out, Emotional Fitness at Work, The Happy Couple, which is also in Chinese, as well as, and we're going to talk about this as well later in the program, 100 Ways to Boost Your Self-Confidence. Believe in yourself and others will too. And we're going to talk about that as we continue here. I want to ask you about that aspect of depression and the connectedness that we all share. We don't always acknowledge it, especially in America. We want our individualism, our life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And I want my privacy, and I want to own my property, and I don't want you anywhere near it, or I will shoot you with my Second Amendment gun, and so on and so forth. I mean, we are so locked into that me against the world, don't tread on me mentality, that we have completely forgotten about how not only connected we are, but how we affect one another.
Everyone has an effect on everyone else. We choose how much we allow in. Some people allow it all in, right? I know people who are distressed about the news, right? And they can't even sit and watch it. They're so upset. They don't realize that they can also turn it off. If you find yourself getting upset, something is wrong. It's an early warning system.
Yeah.
I'm upset. Something's wrong. Deal with it.
Yeah.
Deal with it in the moment, at that moment. The Constitution says the pursuit of happiness.
Yeah.
I have to say, I think that's done us a bit of a disservice. Because being happy all the time isn't possible.
Yeah.
Okay? Not without the aid of drugs we don't want to take. Okay? I mean, nobody can do that. We feel guilty. We do. We feel guilty when we're not happy all the time, when we're feeling normal. Depression is, I'm not talking about depressed. I'm just saying we're feeling normal, like nothing's negative happening, nothing really exciting is happening. We're just being. And guess what? That's really, really okay. In the 60s, Eric Fromm wrote a book, I'm Okay, You're Okay. You remember that?
Mm-hmm.
It should have been, I'm not okay, you're not okay, but that's really okay.
Yeah.
And get into the fact that we're just not perfect beings.
Yeah.
And so we bring ourselves to a point where we can relate to one another because, hey, you've got a flaw, I've got a flaw, all God's children got flaws, right? We all got issues.
Mm-hmm.
And that attitude should allow us to be more understanding, accepting, and giving to people who are in need, our time, our energy.
Yeah. There is, I'm sure, a list of, I'll say characteristics, personality characteristics. I'm sure there's a list. And then the permutations and combinations therein in your field, right? I mean, it's probably rather lengthy.
Oh, every person from every aspect of society is within the field of psychology, psychotherapy, and psychoanalysis. Every personality gets attracted to it. Every country has their own cultural aspects of it as well.
Yeah. And it's interesting how I mentioned earlier about my experiences in college, in psychology class, where we learned, of course, as I said, about the id, the ego, and the superego.
Mm-hmm.
We talk about the ego a lot on this program because that's one of the areas where we mess ourselves up many, many times. I've been very fortunate that I learned some lessons where if I start thinking too highly of myself, this is how connected I like to be. The universe seems to have a way of giving me my comeuppance to bring me back down, so to speak, to earth, or deflating my self-importance, which, again, there's absolutely nothing wrong with you or I saying, hey, I am good at what I do. You, in your case, helping people. All right. Mm-hmm. Helping them through their stuff. And actually, they do the work. You're just kind of there as a facilitator, kind of.
I'm a Sherpa.
Yeah. There you go. There you go. You're carrying the supplies, but they're doing the climb, too. And they're in front of you.
Absolutely. The clients have the answers.
Yeah. And I love doing the work of helping people through these programs.
Mm-hmm.
And saying there are other ways that we can be doing things. We don't have to keep doing it the same old way because, as Einstein said, insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result. It's like putting the DVD or the videotape into the player, watching the same movie, expecting an alternate ending. Okay, on the DVD you could get that, but not on the but not on the videotape. And I think that's one of the things we might touch on is that aspect of the acceptance of, and even without judgment, the acceptance that, yeah, I've been doing the same thing in relationships. I've had hundreds of relationships and they've all
been with the same person.
In a manner of speaking, yeah.
Yes, yeah.
And I keep going to, who was it? Zsa Zsa Gabor, who had, 10 or 12 divorces. I've heard even guys who have been divorced multiple times, double digit times.
Right.
And they say, oh yeah, the problem with this woman was this and this and this. And I kind of sit there going, yeah, but there's a common denominator there you're not acknowledging.
You.
Yeah, you.
Yeah.
What about that aspect of maybe the phrase is not being able to see the forest for the trees.
Not being able to commit. Not being able to drop your resentment so that you do what you were just describing, which is called serial monogamy. You're with one person, you build up a suitcase full of resentments, you drop that person, you go on to the next person, you're with them, build up a suitcase full of resentments, don't open it, don't deal with them, drop that person and go on to the next.
Yeah.
And that's what people do.
And now you either have a lot of luggage or a very full suitcase.
Both.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the problem is that when you do that, you really don't get to experience what relationship is really all about. Yeah. Mark Twain said that a man and a woman, any couple in a relationship, do not really get to know each other after they've been together for a quarter of a century.
Wow.
I love that.
Yeah.
And we have a little ways to go until we get there, but it takes time to get to know someone.
Yeah,
it takes time to find the right way to be. You know, we've changed our way of being with each other a half a dozen times since we've been together to find the right balance.
Yeah.
You always have to be seeking balance.
Yeah.
Things change in your life, you have to rebalance. You get a good job, you have to rebalance. You lose your job, you have to rebalance. It's all about staying in that space. And I'm balancing can be a good thing, even though what you're balancing from is not a good thing.
Yeah. Based upon what you said, my folks are way beyond that. They're 63 years plus that they're celebrating. My
That's
dad's
great.
88. My mom's 85. We're going to visit them in the holidays. And I love talking to them. I always, when I call, I'm always listening to the voice and how are you guys doing? Always checking. But they've already got everything squared away for, and I don't know, my dad could live to be 100. My mother could live to be 100.
These days, not uncommon.
I mean, they have that aspect, that I think that gene in them from their ancestry. Speaking of, you were talking about being Jewish. I did my DNA test and found out that I am a certain percent Eastern European Jew.
Welcome.
I don't know how much, but I'll take it. But mostly Native American, and we're talking North, Central, and South American, which is interesting. But does it matter? I mean, you mentioned at the beginning that we were talking about the different philosophical and psychological attributes, if you will, that different countries, different cultures have, okay? But are they really that different?
No, they're not.
If you were to take an overview of the planet and all of its different types of psychological makeup, those lists that I was referring to earlier, basically the lists are basically because we're all human. We all have those same emotions, even though your story from a literal, physical, reality-based material world experience is different from mine. You experience the same emotions that I do, right?
Of course.
Yeah. And obviously at different intensities, get that too.
Different levels, yes.
But it's still, we're all the same, right?
Every crying child on the planet will respond to an adult lovingly holding their hands and helping them. Everyone responds to kindness. Everyone responds to love if they're not crazed with something else that's going on in their world.
Yeah.
Right? We do. It's culture. It's not about cultural differences.
Right.
You know, my wife is from a completely different culture than mine in Eastern Europe. And we get along because primarily our bottom line is we both want to be nice people and we both want to be nice to each other.
Yeah.
And that's really what we do. I mean, I get corrected a little bit more than she does.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
But that's one of the things I love about it,
yeah.
Right? Because I'm with somebody who I know is looking out for my best interests, yeah. Right? Not hers, mine and ours,
mm-hmm.
Right? And that's the way you mm-hmm. want to deal with it. You have to remember there's three entities in a relationship, you, them, and us. We focus on the us. We do what we can to make the us as good as possible. And then stuff for me happens and stuff for her happens and life is in session.
Yeah. I was in the process of cutting down a tree on the property where we live. It was dead and I wanted to get it so that it would fall where I wanted it to fall without damaging things around it. And I was up there and I was trimming away different things and so on and so forth. And I put the ladder up against the tree after I'd cut off a bunch of limbs. And I got up there and I had the chainsaw. I hadn't fired it up yet, but I was trying to figure out, okay, where do I need to cut this? And I went around the tree several times with the ladder, leaning it and all this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And then I got to a point going, I can't figure it out. I said, okay, fine. So I laid the ladder down because I didn't want anybody to come along and climb it and hurt themselves. And I went in the house. The next day I came back out, I found the way to cut it. It came down the way I wanted. And one of the things that she always does when I want to take on a major project like that is, I think we should call someone and have them do it. I said, I would like to try, but I will go very slowly and I will use the carpenter's method. Measure twice, cut once. Thank you. And that's what I did.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't get hurt. And nobody got hurt. Nothing was damaged. You know, and I was able to bring the tree down. Now, there was a second tree that I was cutting down outside the area of our quote-unquote backyard. I find it funny to call anything out in the wilderness a backyard.
Mm.
But there you go. And I thought I had planned everything out. The tree came down within inches of a fence that I was trying to keep it from falling on. So at least I did. It didn't. But it came a lot closer planned.
No,
but I didn't get hurt.
Yeah.
Okay. And that's the other thing. So I do think about that. And I do trust my wife's. She's always talking about her intuition. Does your wife have that same wonderful innate ability
Absolutely.
To intuit and say, hey, you know, why don't you wait until tomorrow or later this afternoon or da 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 da, whatever the task is, whatever the situation is, before taking that on? Because I got to tell you, there are times when I'm in my ego and I'm going, no, it'll be okay. It's fine. I'm not a problem.
We all know the lesson about sleeping on it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I knew it. I just never followed it. But now I do.
Yeah.
You know, everything, pretty much everything I write, she reads. She lets me know what she thinks of it. And I get, you know, a thumbs up or a, you know, maybe you could fix this.
Yeah.
You know, in-house editor.
Yeah.
Right? But more, it's not about the words that I use.
Sure.
It's about the attitude that I try to convey. Right? I mean, if you can have a relationship where you feel like you're loved every day, where someone is kind to you every day, this is really what life is all about. And then what happens is you pay that forward and you're kind to other people. And you also are more creative because you're not battling with anxiety and depression, which takes away from creativity. And so you can build more things, cut down more trees,
mm-hmm.
you know, create more travel.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
There's a lot of things you can do in your life when you're feeling good. When you're feeling bad, when you're down, you don't want to do anything.
Yeah.
That's the awful part about it.
Yeah. Dr. Barton Goldsmith, PhD, is my guest. Actually, I guess that's redundant to say doctor and PhD, come to think of it. But that's okay. And we're talking about a lot of different subjects in your realm of psychotherapy.
Correct.
Okay. And you're here on occasion here in Santa Barbara.
Well, I'm up here more regularly
now. And do you have an office here in Santa Barbara?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
I want to give out that information as well as we continue here on the program. I'm Richard Dugan. I want you to keep listening because we have a whole lot more to talk about. And speaking of talking about it, we're going to talk about the 100 ways to boost your self-confidence. Believe in yourself and others will too. I don't know that we'll get through all 100, but we'll touch upon the maybe the top 10 or something like that. But that seems to be... Self-esteem seems to be the biggest issue that I have been associated with or aware of since the early 80s when I went through my first self-development program, LifeSpring.
Right. Know it well.
And then I went through several levels of that, two or three levels of that, mm-hmm. And then in the 90s, late 80s, early 90s, I met with a gentleman by the name of George Adair, who had created the program. I think the first one was Omega Vector, and then they changed the name of it to Delta. Maybe it was the reverse. And I went through several of those, and he took his teachings from Desjardins and mm-hmm. the Zero Point, and then incorporated what I love to call the Ancient Wisdom Teachings, which incorporates
everything.
Just everything, mm-hmm. just so many different things. And we used to attend his monthly Monday meetings. We're little booster shots between the 5-day intensives that he would hold.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the fascinating thing about that was that they were free. You contributed whatever you felt you wanted to. You didn't have to, but they obviously left it open. And I remember the first one I went through. My wife wanted to go. She found out about it. My first wife. She found out about it. And she wanted to go. And I'm just like, I went through LifeSpring. I'm good, you know. Well, my wife, you don't know this, my first wife was totally blind.
Mm.
So.
It made sense.
I got to go.
Yeah.
So I went thinking, I'll just sit back here and I'll be fine. No, you have to sit up here with her. Okay. And before I knew it, of course, I was fully involved in the program. It's hard not to be. What are your thoughts about those kinds of programs that now LifeSpring, and it was sort of an offshoot, I think, of EST. What they would do is they would first they would break you down and then they would build you up. But Omega and Delta Vector, that's not what they did. They just got you to tell the truth. And one of the most frustrating truths that they got you to understand the first night was there are a lot of you here who you say you don't want to be here, but I'm here to tell you that you do. If you didn't want to be here, you would be somewhere else. But you're not somewhere else. You're here, so you want to be here. And the logic was inescapable.
Right.
I mean, really.
Yes.
And then, of course, I'm looking around the room at people and I'm thinking, because I'm interviewing all these people and finding out about all this psychology and therapy and this and that and the other, thinking, boy, I wonder when these people are going to get it. And I think it was by the third day I realized, wait a minute, I'm in the room too. Oh, me too.
When am I going to get it?
But what do you think about these programs? I don't know of any today.
There's a reason for that,
because
they weren't really, I think as a business model, they were successful for a little while, mm-hmm. and I think they helped some people in some ways, but they're really, you can't do the same thing in a huge group process, and when I did it, I think there were at least 500 people in the room, if not a lot more.
Wow.
You know, it was big.
Yeah.
And this went on through the 80s and 90s, for a long time, it was very deep. A lot of people did the S thing and the like. I think what we discovered is that there's really no replacement for one-to-one therapy.
Yeah.
Because whereas you can relate to a few people in the group, you can't relate to everyone. And your individual stuff is probably not going to get looked at that carefully. Yeah. The few dozen people that get called up on stage, you know, to do a process, well, that's that one area they probably processed very well. The rest of it, I'm not so sure. Yeah. The effectiveness happens when you're sitting with someone who you have a good relationship with and you trust. Harvard Mental Health said that the most important aspect of therapy was not the methodology the therapist used or what the client had gone through and what the problem was. The most important thing was how well they got along.
Yeah, yeah.
How good their relationship is. Because if you don't have a good relationship with the person that you're doing that work with, the work with, then you're not going to be open.
I've been to one therapist in my life.
Mm-hmm. Now two.
Well, you're right. Now two. And it was at the behest of my wife and her best girlfriend, a female. And they said that I was depressed and that I needed to go see somebody. Mm-hmm. And I'm going, okay. Well, I thought, I'm willing to take a shot. I went to four sessions. And in those four sessions, the therapist said two things that made it only four sessions. First of all, she asked me how to list all of my friends that I could think of. Just give her a bunch of names. And all but one or two were female.
Mm-hmm.
And and she said that there was a problem there.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, really? Because in my line of work, the majority of people who I interview are female.
Mm-hmm.
Strangely enough. This has nothing to do with I don't enjoy interviewing male guests. I don't have a problem with that. But the second thing she said on the last day, the fourth session, was she said, "You have character flaws."
Oh, God.
And
I'm sorry.
I thought, really? Okay. And that was pretty much the end of that. And I added insult to injury. Mm. I would never do this today. I didn't pay her.
Ah.
Not a dime. I said, you didn't help me. You didn't even consider the possibility that you could actually be doing more damage, more harm than good by saying the things you said. I thought, if you, Barton, were to speak to someone, what word or phrase would you use to describe their quote-unquote character flaws?
I would never use a phrase like that. It's not something – I'm not about describing people's flaws to them. They need to tell me what they want to work on.
Right.
And I will help them get to that place. If that means they have to do some growth in an area, some work in an area, so be it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, we all have flaws, but there's a way that you phrase things
so
that someone is going to accept them, take them in, and utilize what you've said. When you insult someone, right, or you're cruelly parental on that level, you know, they're not going to get you.
Yeah.
They're not going to take it in. They're not going to get well.
Yeah.
Right? And to be honest with you, I've said countless times, if you don't feel that the session was worth it, you don't have to pay me.
Yeah.
Because I don't need to make money that way.
But at the same time, you're dealing with an intangible or untangible science, if you will. I guess that's the right word to call it. That cannot and probably does not and you will not give guarantees because – you know, it's like giving guarantees that the water that falls from the sky won't hit the ground.
No, you can't. You can't give guarantees. What you can guarantee, though, is that you will give your best efforts. You will work very hard to help this person find what they need to find, find the answers they need to find so they can feel better again.
And you're not looking at necessarily – it's like – I know that there are – I'm sure there are some therapists in various areas – who are looking to find clients for long-term therapy. And yet I've in my interviewing with people, whether they do the various modalities of energy healing and so on and so forth, what have you, they start training other people to do it because they can't get to everybody.
Right.
And they would love to work themselves out of business.
Mm-hmm.
And I would think you probably would too.
Absolutely.
Because you do hear kind of the same kinds of stories over and over, and that's got to get a little monotonous.
It's not the monotony. Take in a lot of pain.
Yeah.
You take in a lot of pain, and so it's difficult work. It's very difficult work.
Do you consider yourself an empath in that respect?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, absolutely.
So how do you protect yourself from that inundation?
I've been doing this for a long time.
Okay.
And I've gotten to the point where I know how to protect myself psychically.
Okay.
Right? Psyche-ly.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And the other part of it is that I listen when my being and my body say, it's too much.
Right.
You know, you're doing, when it gets to be too much, I listen.
Right.
And I back off and right. I say, you know, let's see each other in 2 weeks or, you know. Because if you're not in the right, if the therapist is not in a good place, then you're not going to do good therapy.
Yeah.
Right? And
yeah.
If it gets over, it's going to get overwhelming. I have a friend who, I don't know if this was the greatest choice he made, but he went from being a therapist to being a lawyer. Right? Because you just can't do therapy forever. Right? And so the other part about it is that you do other things.
Yeah.
Something that David Viscott taught me about was that you can't be a therapist if you don't have a full practice with a waiting list.
Hmm.
Because if you're just making it and a client gets better and is ready to be let go from therapy, the word they use is terminate, but I don't like that.
No.
Ready to graduate.
There you
from
go.
Therapy,
there you
right?
Go.
Somewhere inside of you, there's your survival instinct would go, oh my God, if they leave, then I'm not going to be making that money, and what am I going to do? You know, and you so you have to put yourself in a position where having the income from therapy is not as important as doing the work.
Yeah.
So you either have, you know, a full practice with a waiting list that works really well. Mm-hmm. You have other sources of income, or you're independently wealthy.
But here's almost the catch 22 to that. It's almost like, okay, I really want to help this person, help them to move on, you know, and so forth. And at the same time, you're going, okay, if he moves on, I need to find some more unbalanced people.
You know? It's not that I
not
don't
the
think,
right term. Not the right
well,
term.
Well, no, but I hear what you're saying.
Yeah.
I get it. I get it.
I got to find some more people to help.
It's you're in the helping profession.
Yeah. Yeah.
The people that you need to help.
Right.
The people that are going to do best with you.
Mm-hmm.
If you're living right, right. If you're doing this the right way, they're going to come to you.
Right.
You're
so
going
this
to find
is
them.
You have to trust the universe to take care of you with the tools that you use to help people.
If it's working, if you're helping people, they're going to tell other people.
Yeah.
And then and that's how you build a therapy practice.
It seems that there are those who actually wear the therapy badge as a badge of honor. You know, I'm in therapy. And they're telling everybody.
Well, especially if you're in Hollywood.
Yeah. It's like, I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with being proud of the fact that you've sought out help. Don't get me wrong. I think that's fine. But, you know, to brag that you're in therapy, almost bragging, as if it's, you know, I just bought $1 million house and I never thought I would ever own $1 million house.
For some people, it's like wearing a shirt that says, I'm working on myself.
Yeah.
Right?
Okay.
Like the end of Dances with Wolves when Rain in his face says, do you not see me? I am your friend. Do you not see me? I'm working on myself.
Yeah.
I'm getting better.
Yeah.
Right? And they want to share that. They also want to be accepted for it.
Yeah.
And I think that someone who is open enough to say, hey, I'm in therapy, not as a brag, but as a statement of, again, I'm working on myself.
Right.
Right. That deserves a little bit of applause or acknowledgement,
sure.
Especially if you've seen, you know, someone who's been in trouble. Working with an alcoholic who's been a heavy drinker for 25, 30, 35 years, and they stop because of the work they're doing with their therapist.
Yeah.
That's a lot. That's a great gift you're giving to a lot of people.
Is self-confidence and self-esteem the same term for the same thing?
Pretty much.
Or I should say, are they two different terms for the same thing?
They're two different terms for the same thing,
okay.
Pretty much, yeah.
To that end, you have 100 ways to boost your self-confidence or self-esteem. Do you find that most people are lacking that?
Absolutely.
It below 50%
epidemic in the country.
Yeah.
If we had more self-esteem, if we had more self-confidence, then we would not be rude to other people. Back to the civility thing,
yeah.
Right? If you feel good about yourself, you have no need to take someone else down.
Yeah.
It's really simple psychology. People who take other people down, who put other people down, who are mean, don't feel good about themselves. Yeah. And that's just a projection of that feeling when they're mean to someone.
You know, it's extraordinary that as I observe going back to the early 80s and then into the 90s and the 2000s, in the 80s, it was you find out what makes you tick and talk, as you said at the beginning of the program, and you find out what the problems are in your past, and you blame on your parents.
Yeah, we all do that.
Right. And then in the 90s, we began to deal with the issue, late 80s, early 90s, we began to deal with codependency.
Yes.
We started to get in touch with our responsibility for why we are where we are. Mm-hmm. Yeah, mom and dad played a role, but it's still all on me.
You can change it.
Uh-huh. You can change it. And we sort of went through a level space up until the last few years when all of a sudden, somehow, some way, I know how, I know what way, but somehow, some way, we are back into the victim mentality all over again. And I sit here going, No, I've already done this. I have dealt with this. I am not a victim. Nobody did this to me, and it's not their fault that I am, we are, you are, they are, the way that I am, you are, we are, they are. I'm taking responsibility here.
Yes, you are.
And yet, we've got people out there that are telling us that it's somebody else's fault. And we're talking about all through the media, on all different levels.
Yes.
And it's like, wait a minute, stop it.
You know, if you blame, shame, and complain, you don't get much else done.
Yeah.
Right? So, yeah, we've got problems. There's stuff going on in our society that's horrendously horrid. Okay?
Yeah.
I'm there. I get it.
Yeah.
All right? But if you let that stop you from being a good person, then they're winning.
Yeah.
Right? The bad people are winning. You have to fight against them.
Yeah.
And you just do that by being the best you that you can be.
Wear the t-shirt. I'm working on myself.
Right.
Turn off the stuff. Turn it off. Okay?
For a while, anyway.
And get involved in an intimate relationship with your partner.
Exactly.
Or with friends.
Exactly.
And those kinds of things.
That's called life.
Yeah.
That's what it's about. It's not about arguing with the pundits, you know, and opinions are great, you know. I love all of that stuff.
Yeah.
I'm a news hound. I think it's fascinating,
yeah,
for lack of a better word.
Exactly.
Right? Crazy, but fascinating. Still, it does take us out of the one-to-one, I'm human, you're human, let's just enjoy the company of one another, because that's really what life is about.
Yeah. I have thoroughly enjoyed our time together, and I thank you so much for being on the program today and sharing with us your insights into, again, a lot of different areas that we've gone into today. There's certainly a whole lot more to talk about. And I look forward to not only having you back again, but also hearing you on your own program in the not-too-distant future as well on this fine station.
Thank you.
And I have three final questions that I like to ask my guests. And those three final questions are, first of all, who is Barton Goldsmith?
Barton Goldsmith is the proud and honored husband of Angelica Goldsmith. I also happen to be a doctor of psychology, a psychotherapist, and a writer.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you're doing now?
I want to make the world a better place. It's that simple. My mission statement: to improve the humanity of humankind.
And finally, what is your life's purpose?
To be the best person I can be touch as many souls with goodness that I can, and back to, I want to make the world a better place. That has always been my driving force.
You have a website?
I do.
Tell us.
BartonGoldsmith.com.
So hard.
B-A-R-T-O-N, Goldsmith.com.
BartonGoldsmith.com. We will be linked to your website.
Thank you.
People can find out more about you, get in touch with you, get some of your books if they want them in Chinese, like The Happy Couple.
Or whatever
is available.
Yes.
They can do that, too. And again, we thank you so much for giving us time here on the program. This has been fantastic. And we do need to continue this conversation. That's, by the way, a phrase I've heard when you hear about controversies over certain subjects that were brought up, words that have been used, that at least it's opened up. You may not have liked the words that were used or what have you, but at least it's opened up the conversation.
It's also a good way to end a therapy session. I think we should continue talking about this.
I like it. And we will. And I thank you for listening to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We are giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. And until next time, love, Talal.